Can I observe that if no one can answer this question, that is a very serious problem? Because this is, as Randy indicates, this is live and now.
Hal Schroeder?
I just want to ask, we're in a situation now where concerned entities may be continuing to survive. They may not change your legal structure, but you may have tremendous influx of capital to the point where you're diluting, massively diluting existing shareholders. Does that in and of itself trigger a going concern? Because the concern that those shareholders, the initial shareholder base invested in, has so dramatically changed, they are no longer the dominant shareholder. Someone else has come in. And as I read through all this, that thought kept coming up. Is that in and of itself the potential of being extremely diluted down, should that also trigger a going concern? That may be a question more for the FASB. And I don't want to yield quite all my time because I do have a question on one of the slides.
I guess I'll give you the short answer. I don't think if you read the definition of a going concern or the indications of things that would contradict the going concern assumption, that a dilution of existing shareholders would meet the test. So that might be of great interest to you, but I don't think it meets the test of whether something no longer is a going concern.
Because that's a different concern going forward. That's why I asked the question. Could I come to my question now that I originally had?
I'm sorry?
Oh, is that, may I go ahead and ask my question now that of Joe that I originally had?
Yes.
Oh, okay, thank you. Joe, on the top of page 11 in this handout that we have, you have a slide here that has a point on running bankruptcy prediction models. I wasn't clear on the point that you were making. Are you saying that you suggest that auditors run these prediction models?
It would seem to me that that's something you could do very quickly. Mm-hmm. The data is downloadable. And I think I won't mention the firm. I know one firm already runs something similar to this. Maybe others do as well. And depending upon the output of that model, it affects their risk assessment of the client, and then they adjust their audit procedures accordingly.
What you're suggesting here makes all sense in the world, because I know that the bank auditors themselves have recommended something very similar in evaluating loan portfolios. And what I was surprised is that your last study was only 1980. And I would have expected that there have been, during the 90s, there were tremendous revisions to those models and updates and improvements.
I picked what I view as the seminal papers, Hal.
Okay.
You know, sometimes the seminal papers are the early papers.
Ah.
There's been more recent work that has essentially updated the coefficients, which I think is what you're getting at, that would be attached to the various ratios.
Okay, so everything's pointing in the same direction.
Yeah.
And on that same slide, you say evaluate changes in credit ratings and the pricing of credit default swaps. I was surprised that you didn't mention stock movements.
I'm sorry?
I'm surprised that you did not mention stock movements. There have been some studies out there that suggest when you get single-digit stock prices, they don't come back.
No, you're right.
And they've actually been more accurate than credit ratings.
You're right. I think that's a fair addition.
Okay.
Galen Hansen.
I just have a quick question, and I direct it to Peter. In the proposal, and apparently in the international standards, it referred to all information about the future that you would take into account, but we dropped the word all at the FASB, and I was just sort of interested just what, because you didn't really say what the reason behind that was.
Yeah, the reason was there was a concern that using the word all implied that you'd have to go on, the auditor would have to go on, or management would have to go on a hunt and destroy mission to uncover every piece of data. So we just wanted to soften that, and so we put the focus more on relevant information that you can reasonably know.
Jim Cox.
Well, first of all, I want to thank Joe for taking the time to put these slides together. I thought it was really helpful, and it helped us really discuss things. And my question really goes to, it's framed by something for Joe talked, and that is what kind of disclosures we could have to better facilitate efficient pricing of stocks in anticipation of going concern. And I wonder if there might be just a kernel of insight there provided by something that Joe has in a slide that looks like it's labeled here 33 in the consecutive order here. But the studies there where it's the unexpected opinion, going concern opinion, what made it expected? Otherwise, do you remember the studies? I mean, I don't remember those studies, but I'm wondering if you...
Generally, what made it expected were things like deteriorating financial ratios, recurring operating losses, cash flow deficits, a lot of the language, bluntly, that's in AU 341. So from public filings, you could look at this and you could say this company is likely to fail. Well, when you give them a going concern, that's really not new information to the market. But where it was more ambiguous based on the public filings and a going concern was issued, then it was a surprise and the market reacted in a significantly negative way.
Just to follow up there, we don't know whether part of the reason why the in the unexpected situations, whether that was a result of cooking the books or otherwise masking things, it could have more likely we would just assume it was a rapid deterioration.
There is some work, Jim, and I looked at it, but I don't recall all the details because I didn't end up putting it in the slides, where they look at bankruptcy and they also have a variable as to whether or not there was a fraud that ultimately was related to that bankruptcy and how that affects both the ratios and the user judgment, but it's clearly an issue that you'd want to be aware of.
Bill Miller.
Yeah, I've got a question for you, Joe, in terms of your study and your analysis, in terms of how the analysis was designed. How did you go about doing that to remove factors such as rating agencies, reviews and things like that in terms of predictors of default? I guess I'm trying to get to the question of, do we already have enough out there in terms of a predictor of default that's more timely than once a year or on an annual basis going through all this and going through the excruciating experience of having to wrestle with all of these things that's different from an audit activity? Typical audit activity, I guess there's the two components of audit activity. One, which is the current facts of the financial statements, and the other is the look forward evaluation of all the uncertainty and things like that.
Was there, William, was there a particular slide in particular, or you just more?
Well,
big
no,
picture?
You talked about the experience for a 10 year period, that 72 to
92,
and yep. You had, was that the one that had 204?
655 bankruptcies.
Oh, no. I guess I was thinking about the 2007 where you had 204, I guess, and experiences, and 56% were given going concerns. And, a portion of those actually went into bankruptcy. And
okay.
I'm just, I see the results in the, yeah. of your study and the like, but I'm just curious whether you were able to isolate those solely to the going concern, or were there other factors that also weighed into that?
Well, if I'm understanding you right, all we did there is we pulled all the bankruptcy filings in 2007, and we just looked at the nature of the opinions that had been issued before the bankruptcy filing, the nature of the management disclosures in the notes, and the nature of the management disclosures in the 10-Qs, just to provide descriptive information so that the SAG members and observers had some baseline data as to what's going on now.
Okay, because when I saw those numbers, I looked at it, and it didn't suggest to me a very good predictive value based on, your real question I'm trying to get to is, what's the value is being added to, the investor from this versus all the other information you've got in the material, the 10-Ks, the annual report?
I think that's
rating agencies. And I'd really be curious about how the rating agencies look at this stuff. And
I think that's in the eye of the beholder, William. Is 56% good or bad? And in fairness to the profession, it's easy to be a critic. I think this is a tremendously hard thing to do and get right. And so I really have a lot of respect for what they try to do, because I think it's very hard to do well. The research would suggest that bankruptcy prediction models aren't any better. So it's not like, hey, just use a bankruptcy prediction model, it's better. To rely on credit rating agencies, they're not the most credible organizations in the world right now. And sorry, with all due respect over there. They've got their own set of problems right now. And I would say the auditing profession has come out of this period of time more unscathed than the credit rating agencies have. A lot of people are relying more on changes in the price of credit default swaps. That seems to be a more real-time indicator than changes in, let's say, a AAA to a single A.
That's a better predictor than now, the auditor's report.
To the best of my knowledge, William, I'm not aware of any academic research that has examined the ability of changes in credit default swaps to predict bankruptcy. And maybe that's better than bankruptcy prediction models. Maybe that's better than auditors. Maybe that's better than changes in credit ratings. And maybe that's where we should go. I'm not aware of anybody who's looked at that.
Greg Jonas.
A little background about what I've learned about ratings and bankruptcy. The rating agencies don't try to predict bankruptcy, interestingly. If that were the model, then there would be two rating classes rather than 21. There would either be AAA or C. What the rating agencies try to do is rank ordinally on the 21-point scale credit risk, and then publish statistics about historically a portfolio of securities ranked at a certain rate have a certain propensity toward failure or bankruptcy. So we can say, for example, that a portfolio of CAA-rated securities have a 65% chance of bankruptcy, even though we can't say that any one company within that portfolio we think we're predicting bankruptcy. So it's based on the laws of large numbers, and we're trying to only ordinarily rank companies on the scale. We're not trying to predict bankruptcy. It's really a fundamentally different thought process than the notion of trying to understand going concern. I'll have more comments about that when we get into the issues. But
thank you, Greg. Steve Rafferty?
Just an observation. I think Joe's done a fabulous job here putting together some really meaningful stuff. But, you know, with respect to the 56%, I don't know that we know that that is a good number, because that's 56% of the entities that went bankrupt. We don't know how many of them went bankrupt for reasons that didn't exist at the date of the prior auditor's report. And in today's environment, I think you see a lot of instances where companies are going bankrupt, but the conditions that drive them bankrupt didn't exist a year ago. So I don't know if the number is really 56% or not.
Wayne Collins.
For Joe, on the bankruptcy prediction models, what is the time period over which they are making their prediction generally?
They run them out different time periods. They all run out at least a year. Some have run out, some of these models have run out 3 to 5 years, as you'd expect, Wayne. Once you start getting out 2, 3, 4, 5 years, the predictive accuracy really starts to degrade in a very significant way.
Right. So I assume then perhaps the auditor's predictive accuracy would also degrade to the same extent?
No question. Yeah. I think anything beyond a year or shortly longer than a year is very unreasonable to expect anyone to be able to do.
Good.
Hal Schroeder, and then we'll go on to the more detailed topics. Oh, I guess we'll go on to the more detailed topics.
Well, I was just going to say on the understood the credit rating observation, and kind of directionally we're dealing with the law of large numbers, and groups of credits tend to go bankrupt over certain time periods. The other meaningful statistic that we've looked at is not only the credit rating, but the gap between the credit and the CDS. There's an implied credit rating in the CDS. And once you get, and we've seen some as much as 8 and 9 rating level differences between the CDS and the credit rating. And that's anything over 5 really starts to become predictive.
Well, thank you again to all our 4 panelists for starting this discussion. At this point, I would like to move on to the specific topics we outlined in the briefing paper. And the first topic I'd like to talk about is the time period for assessing going concern. as presented by Peter, the proposed accounting standard ongoing concern right now will go beyond 12 months and has some language regarding the foreseeable future. This is different than what's currently in the auditing standards, which basically caveated the going concern time period not to exceed 1 year beyond the date of the financial statements being audited. The PCAOB is considering proposing changes that would conform its auditing standard to the requirements in the FASB proposed accounting standard. This leads me to our first question. If the time period the auditor would use to evaluate an entity's ability to continue as a going concern is extended beyond a 12-month period following the end of the fiscal year as required by the board's auditing standards, how would that affect the overall audit of an issuer? Galen Hansen?
I'll speak up. Just a couple of things. And in the world of small filers, I think even though it might not be intended, it does, believe it or not, happen where a delinquent filer might take advantage, let's say, of having a very short period of time to get from 1 year from the balance sheet date. And frankly, I think that the proposal to make it 1 year from the filing date makes a lot more sense, just to remove what might otherwise be an artificial incentive. Then the other thing, obviously, then it means that you're going to have to project out perhaps several more months in your management will, and obviously the auditor is going to have to test projections and other evidence over that period of time, including loan compliance, to make sure that you're going to meet those standards to remove the going concern qualification.
Wayne Collins?
I guess the proof will be in the exact language that is used. It wasn't quite clear as to the tightening up language. I heard things like it would generally be limited to a year, but I don't know what the word generally means. What are the circumstances where generally would not be appropriate? And I think it should be made clear that we're talking about a period perhaps shortly after a year. I mean, I think in the discussion that we just had, I heard it would be unreasonable to ask an auditor to go anything shortly beyond that 1 year period because of the degradation of the forecasting process.
Any other comments regarding the time period? Waiting for the FASB to issue their final accounting standard? I understand. Okay, well, I guess let's move on to our next topic relating to evaluating audit procedures for evaluating an entity's ability to continue as a going concern. The PCAOB's auditing standards state that it's not necessary to design audit procedures solely to identify conditions and events that, when considered in the aggregate, indicate there could be substantial doubt about an entity's ability to continue as a going concern for a reasonable period of time, and that the results of the auditing standards performed to achieve the other audit objective should be sufficient for that purpose. It goes on to say the auditor should evaluate whether information that comes to the auditor's attention as a result of all the audit procedures performed indicates there could be substantial doubt about an entity's ability to continue as a going concern. Therefore, should the PCAOB standard on going concern require the auditor to perform procedures specifically designed to identify conditions and events that indicate that there may be substantial doubt about a company's ability to continue as a going concern for a reasonable period of time? If so, what types of specific procedures should the auditor perform in this regard? Hal Schroeder?
If you'd asked me this question a year ago, I would have probably said no, nothing specific, and you'd know a going concern issue when you see it. But given what's going on here in D.C. with the banks, and the landscape has changed so much, and I'll put healthcare into the same category, I'm starting to lean toward having some very specific procedures that would look at the macro backdrop that an industry is operating in not just the company but the industry collectively, how is it changing and what implications does that have? And I know that to a certain degree that's already being done, but if that could be incorporated into this standard, it seems to make a lot of sense to me given what we're dealing with today.
Greg Jonas.
I could have introduced this at any point in the discussion, but I choose to do it now because I think before one can think about procedures, you have to have a clear idea of what the goal is. And I've managed to confuse myself about what the concept of going concern is. I can identify at least four, and a fifth was put up earlier when we mentioned shareholder dilution. But my four are, do we mean that the company can't pay its debts when due per the debt contract? Does it mean Chapter 11 type reorganization, or does it mean out of bankruptcy reorganization, or does it mean liquidation? And until we can decide which of those we're talking about, I can't answer the question, what procedures am I trying to do, because I don't know what I'm trying to shoot at. My proposal is that we clearly define it, and my vote would be to define it in the first bucket as the ability to pay debts when due per the debt contracts. And I would make this discussion all about liquidity. Then I would attack the word substantial doubt. Again, before I decide on procedures, because I've managed to confuse myself about what substantial doubt means. Does it mean a 30% chance of a bad event, kind of the notion of reasonably possible? Does it mean a 51% chance of a bad event, the notion of more likely than not? Or does it mean a 75% chance of a bad event, the notion of probable? Again, until I can understand the probabilities here, I can't do procedures very well. Now, interestingly, at our table last night, we took a poll about what folks thought substantial meant. And we ranged from a low of 30% to a high of 75% with someone at 51%. I mean, some of this is inherently uncertain. I understand that. But we shouldn't exacerbate that by using a nebulous word when we can just clarify what the heck we mean and at least take that uncertainty out of the question. My vote here is we should mean 30% reasonably possible and be clear about it. With those two things decided, then I can put my mind to this question, and I think things become a little clearer.
Bill Miller? Oh, Galen Hansen?
I would probably respectively disagree with you, Greg, on the issue of that this is solely on liquidity. In fact, I think liquidity, weak balance sheets and losses are more a symptom, and I was going to wait until we were talking about the reporting aspect of this, but I think the underlying causes of lack of liquidity is what would be more meaningful to investors, to users, in terms of knowing more specifics about why things are happening. Do we have labor issues, supply issues, marketing, pricing, reliance on a single product, any number of reasons? And I don't know that the auditor has to cover in detail each and every one of those in their report, but I think we're kind of fooling ourselves if we think that we've solved the problem by just saying we got a weak balance sheet. We have lost some money. I think that's one of the things that Joe's slides are showing us is we're sort of reporting these things after the fact, and we need to get ahead of the ball game here.
Jim Schnur.
First of all, I would agree with Greg that I think there is confusion about what substantial doubt means in terms of what the level of probability is. And then to pick up on something that Randy said, I think, in his remarks, if you look at the ISAs, they talk about material uncertainty. They don't talk about substantial doubt. And I think we would be much better off if the disclosure in the notes and then the auditors opinion talked about material uncertainty, because I think we have better experience dealing with the word material in a lot of ways in our audit procedures, as well as making judgments about the financial statements. So I think the disclosures would be clearer. I think there would be less confusion about what that meant. It would be a better description of what actually exists, that there are conditions that create material uncertainty.
Gary Kubarek.
This is really a question, Bella, to yourself and the PCOB team. If the FASB finalizes its exposure draft on it, I mean, that becomes an audited footnote in time when finalized, or the case maybe you don't have a disclosure of substantial doubt, you also audit for what's not there, but you management has to prepare an assessment, an assertion that either does or does not have substantial doubt. So you have to audit that. So with that as a backdrop, I'm not sure what this adds. Do you need this if the FASB standard is finalized, you know, at or near its current form? What does this do, the regular audit of footnote, or the audit that I don't need this footnote already would do?
I think what this is trying to get at is similar to other types of procedures that are performed in other areas during an audit. Because this is such a sensitive topic, would an auditor be better positioned to actually perform very specific procedures regarding an entity's ability to continue as a going concern and management's assessment of that, actually focusing more directly rather than taking the other procedures they performed on all the other areas and looking at that in the aggregate, but really targeting specifically this area? And would that be beneficial for them?
But I think what you'd be doing is you'd be giving guidance on how to audit an area that you're required to audit, I think is what you're saying. I mean, because there's big companies got 25 or 30 footnotes. You don't have procedures on how to audit, you know, the information in shareholders' equity footnote or any number of footnotes. Use the regular standards of due professional care and other audit procedures, looking for evidence in support or evidence that refute, you know, management's assertion. So I don't have a problem with your writing this or requiring it, or say, when management has these disclosures, here's the sort of steps the PCOB believes you should do. And presumably management, if I read the ED correctly, is going to have to do some form of an assessment. You know, hopefully most of the time they don't need any disclosures, but they still have to do the assessment. So you have to audit their assessment. So when I said, when you require the auditor to perform procedures specifically designed to identify conditions and events, identifying conditions and events, I think that's what the FASB is asking management to do. So you might rearticulate the question, say, when FAS 162 or whatever its final number is comes out, here are the procedures we believe are appropriate under the general circumstances. So again, this will become an audited footnote. So.
Steve Rafferty.
A couple of observations here. One on the notion of procedures. I don't believe there's really a need to do that, because I think we are almost always, if not always, aware of the conditions and events that might give rise to substantial doubt. By virtue of the work that we do already, that might only be enhanced if management has a responsibility to do the same thing. I tend to gravitate more towards the international approach of disclosing the material uncertainties that might cast doubt. I think that is a possibility to, with adequate disclosure, raise the red flags that readers need. And I think I agree with Greg that this is all about liquidity. It's not, however, just about the balance sheet, to say we have a weak balance sheet. It's liquidity for whatever reason. Whether that's a regulatory action, whether that's a bank restructuring debt action, whether that loss of a material customer, whatever that is. But at the end of the day, it drives a liquidity issue, which is the way 341 is written today. And I think that's where we need to probably stay with that.
Joe Carcello.
I think there's a couple of reasons why the auditors
opinion is valuable, the auditor's going concern opinion is valuable, even over and above management's note. One is that I don't think we can assume that all financial statement readers read the 10-K from cover to cover. And, you know, they're different clientels. And one clientele may be a user who looks at the audit report and looks at the financials and moves on. And by having an auditor paragraph in the audit report, there's some value. A second thing is that some users like to be able to set up electronic screens. These electronic screens can be based off of audit analytics or other similar databases. And until the notes are XBRL tagged, which then my understanding is the XBRL taxonomy has not yet encompassed all the notes, they wouldn't be able to do that, where they can do a search off of the opinion itself. A third reason is more subtle, but on a third, when the FASB standard is issued, you may have a situation where there are some notes that, let me use the word, they're borderline. It's a borderline issue as to whether the note really meets the FASB standard. You could make an argument on either side. And to the extent that the auditor has the ability to add a paragraph on going concern, the auditor may conclude the note, we can defend the note, it's borderline, but we can defend the note, and we've got a paragraph in here talking about going concern, so users are alerted. If you eliminate that auditor paragraph, now the note issue is a make or die issue, right? Because that's it. If the note doesn't adequately communicate, the auditor has no other meaningful way of communicating it. Now what's the decision? The decision is a clean opinion or what? A qualified opinion. And my understanding is the SEC does not accept qualified opinions for gap departures. And so that becomes an even more contentious issue than the going concern issue is now.
Jim Schnur? Randy Fletchall?
Well, just one comment on this one. I know as you go through the rest of your questions to talk about possible changes to the standards and on reporting, we talked about the definition of a going concern. I mean, one of the things that troubles me is we are having this conversation now, and the FSB is about to finalize its project. And one of the things I don't think we want to end up with is, you know, a lack of symmetry between the accounting standard and the auditing standards. And yet I think, you know, that's why, again, I say I wish this was all that would have happened a little earlier. The accounting standard, rightfully so, was kind of picked up, as you said, existing definitions of going concern, additional existing language about substantial doubt. So if you're serious about the need to make changes to the auditing standard, other than this one that says what procedures might an auditor do, we really need to resolve the timing of the FASB going forward with this project, because you're just going to end up creating something that doesn't match, or else we're really not spending our time very wisely.
Well, is to read the accounting standard once it is issued by the FASB and then look at it and consider AU 341 in light of that and what changes potentially would need to be made. So I think we're all on the right track. We're just, we all wish we could have been talking about the same thing at the exact same time. Any other comments on this topic? Oh, Sam Renzillo?
Well, Bill, I'm not sure I agree with what you just said, that you'll wait until the FASB is all done and then decide. Let's say you decide we ought to get rid of the word substantial doubt, but substantial doubts in FAS 162 sounds like a disaster. So I think that, you know, before either of you go forward, the FASB or the PCAOB, I think we better be certain the direction each of you are going to take. Otherwise, you know, I think we messed it up. As it relates to your question here, I don't believe that there are prescriptive procedures, and I would suggest that your inspection process would be a place to look to as to whether or not, you know, whether you agree or disagree that auditors are making the right calls on going concern, and you know, whether you believe that or not, this question goes to, are auditors identifying the situations that would lead you to a going concern discussion, and then to assess management's plans? And I would argue that this is not an issue that is looking for prescriptive guidance. Maybe to Joe's slides, one could argue that auditors aren't predicting whatever it is substantial doubt is asking us to predict, but I don't think it's because, you know, we just sleep through the issue that this company is in some degree of financial stress. And I think that's what that question goes to.
Larry Salva.
Yeah, I would agree with Sam that I don't, on this specific question about, I don't believe that you need to prescribe specific procedures. I think once it becomes a FASB standard, along the lines of what Gary was getting at before, the auditor will have to read and evaluate the assessment that management has made and perform whatever appropriate procedures, you know, on that assessment to audit that footnote. And on the other issue of the integration of the audit standard with the accounting standard, or financial reporting standard, I would suggest is that the staff indicated in a footnote, I think, in the briefing paper here, that you would consider the ISA 570 requirements as part of a standard-setting project. Well, that seems to be, even though the IAS doesn't have a lot on going concern other than the going concern assumption is fundamental to the preparation of financials, the ISA standard does seem to be kind of integrated and going after, as Jim said, the uncertainty issue. And I do think that's a better way to approach the resolution of this, but that can only be done if it's coordinated with the FASB action to eliminate the kind of strike words, if you will, of substantial doubt and get it focused on the uncertainties that that really run to the heart of the matter.
Okay, any other comments on this topic? Then we'll move on to our next topic, evaluating an entity's projections and forecasts. The PCAOB auditing standards require the auditor to consider management's plans for dealing with the adverse effects of conditions and events that indicate that there is substantial doubt about an entity's ability to continue as a going concern. When prospective financial information is particularly significant to management's plans, the auditing standards require the auditor to request that management provide the information and to consider the adequacy of support for significant assumptions underlying that information. The auditing standards also state that the auditor's consideration should include reading the prospective financial information and the underlying assumptions and comparing prospective financial information in prior periods with actual results and comparing prospective information for current period with results achieved to date. So the question is, what should the auditor's responsibilities be for evaluating an entity's assumptions, such as projected cash flows, underlying a forecast, when mitigation of the adverse effects of events or conditions is based on management's forecast? Tom Teft?
I would say to carry out the responsibilities here, the auditor does need to look at the forecast and the underlying assumptions. I do think, though, it's got to go beyond just a financial analysis. You need to understand what are the operating assumptions behind those financial forecasts, and specifically to the extent those forecasts are going to suggest a change in trajectory of the financials of the underlying business. You need to understand what's going to change. What's going to change from an operating standpoint, either from an action standpoint, a assumption standpoint, something that's going to trigger a change in the overall performance. I don't think it's going to be sufficient just to compare the current forecast to past forecasts or compare actual results to past forecasts. You got to go a little bit deeper than that.
Ted White.
And I realize the statistics that Joe had were a bit old, but I think those would apply directly to this and would require a very high bar, right? If I understood what he presented, it meant that management's arguments contrary to the going concern opinion were, what in almost all cases, wrong, right? Their arguments to the contrary. Right, so I think that, if I'm understanding your question correctly, that would lead you to require a very high bar.
Wayne Collins.
341 and ISA 570 have similar language. 341 talks about considering the adequacy of support for the significant assumptions, and 570 talks about evaluating the reliability of underlying data to generate the forecast and determining whether there's adequate support for the assumptions, which is, I think, pretty close to a, quote, examination of a forecast that's already in the literature. So in terms of just kicking the tires to look at things that should have changed even though management didn't, you're looking at from both ends of the glass in this case. So I think that is a pretty high bar, and I think it's an appropriate bar.
Any other comments? Oh. Bob Dacey.
I just wanted to add a similar comment that ISA 570 includes several procedures which are beyond merely reading, and I think that provides a reasonable framework for the auditor's responsibilities in this area.
Steve Rafferty.
I would echo that. I think what's already in the standard about challenging the assumptions and which assumptions are most important is already there. I think maybe auditors need to go back and read it from time to time, but I think the guidance is adequate. The way I read Joe's slide was to say that auditors are challenging those assumptions and are finding that they can't rely on that near as often as they can rely on financing vehicles to overcome the substantial doubt. I think that's what his slides tell us, is that the management's assumptions are not nearly as reliable as they could be.
Now let's move on to the disclosure in the auditor's report. After considering the identified conditions and events and management's plans for mitigating the adverse effects, the auditor may conclude that there's substantial doubt about an entity's ability to continue as a going concern remains. The auditing standards require the auditor to include an explanatory paragraph in the auditor's report that's been stated earlier. The standard indicates that the auditor's conclusion about the entity's ability to continue as a going concern should be expressed through the use of a phrase, substantial doubt about the entity's ability to continue going concern, or similar wording that includes the terms substantial doubt and going concern. The FASB's proposed accounting standard would require the company to make certain disclosures either when financial statements are not prepared on a going concern basis, when there is substantial doubt about an entity's ability to continue as a going concern. The PCAOB is considering retaining the explanatory paragraph in the auditor's report to highlight the going concern issue, even if the entity is required to make such disclosures. Therefore, if the FASB proposal to require disclosures about an entity's ability to continue as a going concern is adopted, what, if any, changes should be made to the explanatory paragraph in the auditor's report relating to going concern? For example, should the explanatory paragraph be retained substantially in the current form? Should the additional information be added to the explanatory paragraph? And if so, what information? Or should the explanatory paragraph refer only to management's disclosures and conclusions as described in the notes to the financial statements? I know several of our panelists made comments regarding this before, but we'd like to hear the SAG members' views. Steve Rafferty, do you still? Shelley Stein?
I think that the assertions and the financial statements of the notes there too are those of management. So the auditor's report should only refer to management's disclosures in the footnotes, and I don't think the auditors should be making statements and conclusions within their audit report.
Larry Salva.
Yeah, I'd agree with Shelley and actually like the way that 570 approaches it, where which I think you allude to in your footnote 16 here, is that if management has made inadequate disclosure, then a gap departure exists. And the way IAS 570 or ISA 570 approaches that is if that gap disclosure is inadequate, you modify your report appropriately, and then the auditor is called on to point out that there's significant uncertainties that lead to, you know, they use softer words, I think, which actually I think might be useful to consider here, significant doubt as opposed to substantial, and may cause it as opposed to there is substantial doubt. It just softens it up a little bit. I don't know if the representatives from the public firms would think any of their difficult decisions with their or discussions with their clients would be any easier if you weren't fighting over such harsh words as saying you think I'm going to fail in the next 6 months.
Larry, are you recommending it's a, that it be changed to may instead of is? I'm just kind of wondering if it's a may, does that expand the number of companies that you would see disclosures or have this, you know, opinion in the auditor's report?
Yeah, and actually if it does, that's a good thing, because I don't think that this should be just like kind of the last red flag that you get. You know, if there are, you know, significant concerns and very significant uncertainties, I think this type of uncertainty where it runs to the primary premise upon which you're the basis of presentation of the financial statements, that, you know, everything is done as if you're going to continue to, you know, realize your assets and discharge your debts in the normal course of business, if that premise is being called into question because of the existence of significant uncertainties, That's an important fact, and people should be made aware of it with either an emphasis or some reference in the report. And if it may cause doubt, the fact, what's factual is the uncertainty exists. So you would say there is uncertainty, and that may cause significant doubt about ability to continue as going concern. I think that's what you want to communicate, and if that brings in more companies, so be it.
Bill Miller.
Yes, I want to agree with Shelley's point, but to the extent that's not adopted, I would like to at least identify that there's an assumption on the table here that by the auditors opining on this going concern, that it adds value to investors, and being stated in the opinion. And I'd like to challenge that and at least get some analysis that could evaluate that, because, you know, investing is very different today than where it was when those studies were done. And but in particular, index funds. At one point, they were over $1 trillion, with the market move, obviously, and they're in the hundreds of billions. But when you put a going concern language into the audit opinion, then my observation is that has an impact on the price of the stock because it's impacting the cost structure of the company. And as an investor in index funds, you can't get out of that. You have to hold the position. But if you are a knowledgeable investor, you've got all kind of other information out there that's giving you whether that entity is a going concern. You've got your information, your 10-Ks, you got the rating agencies, you got the CDSs, then you got the analysts that cover the stock. So my view, my sense is a lot of the information that the auditors are trying to get at is already out there, and if you take the view that the market's efficient as well, so that my sense is there may be some costs now into the equation that I'd like to at least challenge that assumption.
Any other comments on the audit explanatory paragraph? Charlie Niemeyer.
I'm just seeking a clarification. It's something Sam, you said, and Larry said earlier, but I just want to make sure I understand. And certainly we intend to coordinate our efforts with FASB. But I may not have understood your comments about this, and a lot has been said about the ISA and stuff. And are you suggesting that our approach has been to wait for FASB, right, and to let FASB take the lead, and then we would do follow-up. And I'm getting the impression that you're saying don't necessarily take that approach. If you think that, if, for example, material uncertainty focus should be the emphasis, maybe that should be something that we should be more proactively involved with. Is that the comment?
I won't speak for Sam or Larry, but that was what I was trying to say earlier when I teed up the fact that if the FASB finishes its project, you're very limited as what you do if all you say is I can follow FASB, but in essence I want to keep symmetry, then all the things we're talking about as alternatives, frankly, are off the table. So that was really the point of it, Charlie.
Fine, thank you.
Yes.
Yeah, and Charlie, I'd say that this is one that I have to say didn't get my attention or focus at all. So that, you know, if I think, you know, that what Randy I think was saying before is that if we had had this discussion, this robust discussion back in October, and vetted out some of these issues, maybe we would have influenced or responded differently to the FASB project and suggested that they take out words like substantial doubt or and focus on uncertainties and kind of sync it up more. But I'd be in favor of trying to coordinate this with the FASB and trying to stop them from issuing that standard immediately so it could be better coordinated.
Okay, thank you.
Paul Beswick.
I'll try not to get emotional over this issue either. I think you guys already asked the question I was going to ask, but it seems like the FASB is relying on the existing standard, and we get into a chicken and egg situation where they've pulled it forward without reconsidering it. And now we're talking about what should the auditing standard be reconsidered when we want symmetry here. And so, I mean, am I misinterpreting the message from members here that maybe we need to go call the FASB and say, wait a minute, don't do this. Let's reconsider this. I mean, is that what I'm hearing from the people? And maybe the FASB and the PCOB need to look at this together? Or am I missing what people are saying? All right. Just want to make sure I wasn't misinterpreting anything.
Steve Rafferty.
Just an observation. If we were to go down a path where we reference to a footnote on material uncertainty, I think that's a lower threshold than substantial doubt, and that we would pick up a lot more entities and we'd be focusing a lot more folks on the material uncertainties that are there. And assume for a minute that Joe's statistics were right, that the 56% of the time we get it right. That would mean that 44% of the time folks are relying on us when we get it wrong. And would we be better off saying, let's tell them more often about the red flags and the material uncertainties than have them inappropriately rely on the fact that we didn't actually conclude there was substantial doubt? It seems to me there's a possibility we better serve readers by doing that.
Gary Kubarek.
I'm going to put this comment in the sort of thinking aloud category. You know, intuitively, I like the idea that the footnote describes it all and just get a simple, clean opinion because it's buried in the footnotes. But given the nature of what this is about, I mean, this is going to be among the more important disclosures, one would think, if this is a serious issue we're going to have. And if one of the concerns that I'm hearing on the table is if management is minimizing the disclosures to the point where you can have an argument, are you complying with GAAP, you know, just getting in, but the auditor sort of knows in his heart of heart, maybe you really should have more. So the only place to put more if you can't win management is in your report. Now, does that become an exception in the report, you know, because you have inadequate GAAP disclosures? I'm just going to throw out in the room or for you to think about later on, you might be doing the auditing firms a favor requiring this explanatory paragraph, because that allows, one, it brings emphasis to it, and to the extent that they're uncomfortable that the footnotes aren't quite where they should be, you know, appear to be but really aren't, you're helping them, you know, avoid a conflict with management by saying, look, I've got to have something in my audit opinion. It's, again, it's in the wondering aloud category. I'm not, I intuitively do like the idea of just rely on the footnotes and a clean opinion, but I think, excuse me for being repetitive, but I think given the importance of the subject, you know, companies could be forgiven that they're trying to put the best foot forward in the footnote. The auditors sort of, no, it sounds good, but, you know, so just a thought.
Wayne Cornell.
Actually, I'd just like to ask a question to Joe, if I could, in terms of this issue about, you know, a clean opinion or having an emphasis paragraph. And I was wondering if there's been any academic studies comparing the U.S. model to the Canadian model, because in Canada, you're actually prohibited from issuing an emphasis paragraph. And what is interesting, when the Canadian companies file with the SEC, and there's some 500 of them, they do have a going concern opinion or going concern situation, they'll issue a special report for the U.S. filing. And I was wondering if there's been any comparisons to compare the U.S. disclosures with the Canadian disclosures, because the requirements are the same. And I was wondering, in terms of market reaction, information for investors, if there's been any comparison, one is better than the other, or the advantages or disadvantages.
Wayne, I don't think so. I mean, there's so many academic journals, it's, you know, hard to think through every single journal. But the major journal in Canada is called Contemporary Accounting Research, which is viewed as a top-tier journal in North America. And to the best of my recollection, I don't recall ever seeing something like that. When I get back, I'll look, you know, in recent issues of CAR, see if I see anything, and if I do, I'll send you an email. But I don't think so.
To our last topic. Lastly, the board is interested in any other ideas or thoughts the SAG has on how to improve the auditing standard on going concern. I know that Joe and several other panelists provided their thoughts on some improvements, but I'd like to ask the whole standing advisory group, what additional changes to the auditing standard on going concern should be considered to assist auditors in conducting an audit of an issuer? Jim Schneider.
One area, I think, is if, in terms of the FASB's proposed standard, you know, they bring in a requirement for the interim. And right now, there's really not a lot of guidance from a review standpoint. So I think you would have to address that issue.
Anything else? You're tired, you want to go home? You want us to work with the FASB, I understand. Okay. Well, in that case, I want to thank everyone, including special thanks to our panelists for doing additional research and background and providing context to this very important issue. And at this point, I'd like to turn it over to Jennifer.